Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Very exciting time at Franchise Today, as today starts our third annual franchise legal series, which will run through May 24th. And due to the popular demand of the of our listening audience and the success of our first two legal series, this year's series will also include seven segments, and it's going to culminate in a recap of the then completed IFA legal symposium. And we really feel that this series is a precursor to the upcoming annual legal symposium, which, by the way, is held May 20th. Through 22nd at the J.W. Marriott Hotel in Washington, D.C. And, of course, this series, you know, it's really evolved in such a way that I'm very proud of it. A couple of years back, I spoke with Joe Caruso, a colleague of mine and a well-known franchise expert, and we talked about what can be done to take Franchise Today to a higher level. And the legal series really is the brainchild of Joe Caruso, who's now the co-producer of Franchise Today. And I know I have Joe on the air. Joe, welcome back to Franchise Today. It's always an exciting time as we lead into this legal series.
Yeah, the legal series is probably the most fun aspect of Franchise Today. It also presents us with the greatest amount of work and preparation because our guests are experts and they want the content to be relevant and informative. So it takes a higher degree of effort to really make these shows meaningful for the audience and meaningful for the guests, and it's well worth it.
I know a lot of our guests, and something that I'm very flattered about, and I think it just lends towards all the effort that you put in, that I put in, and also the preparation that our guests put in, and probably more so around the legal series as well as some of the individual segments that we have with franchise attorneys and legal experts, and also the financial experts as well, is that franchisors constantly remind me or tell me that they're using a lot of this material for internal training purposes, which is really, I think, the one of the highest forms of flattery that we can get. Our guest this morning on Franchise Today is Lane Fisher, attorney with Fisher Zucker, one of the preeminent franchise law firms in the country with offices in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Georgia. And I'm proud to say the third-time guest on Franchise Today's annual Franchise Legal Series. But, Joe, if you would, take us to weeks 2 through 7 and tell us what we have in store for us throughout this legal series.
We've got an action-packed, fun-filled series ahead for the audience. We've got next week on the 19th with Lee Play, Social Media and Technology, a moving target for franchising, followed by Safety and Vigilance, Leveraging Franchise Sales Outsourcing with Mark Kirsch, Franchise Compliance Basics and Earnings Claims with Warren Lewis, Litigation and Technology in Franchising, It's Complicated with Ken Pline. Michael Webster will be back with Dynamics of Winning Franchisee-Franchisor Relationships. And then we'll be doing a recap of the IFA Legal Symposium, What Do Franchise Lawyers Talk About?, which should be pretty interesting.
Definitely should be. Well, as I mentioned, today's guest is Lane Fisher. For over 17 years, Lane has represented franchisors in business transactions and complex litigation, including matters related to trademark and copyright infringement, franchise regulatory issues. He's litigated the enforcement of franchise agreement obligations on behalf of franchisors, including non-competition covenants, collections, underreporting, and encroachment claims. He's a frequent speaker at franchise conferences. I'm looking forward to hearing him at the upcoming multi-unit conference in Vegas. He's written extensively on franchise-related issues, appeared on CN8 and CNN. He's a member of the IFA. Anybody at the IFA definitely sees Lee Lane walking around. Definitely not leaning on anything. I love the couch at the IFA convention that he would not let anybody sit on. He's very active, of course, in the IFA and the board of directors. It's Franchise Business Network Task Force. Lee, welcome back to Franchise Today.
Well, thanks, Paul. Thanks so much for having me and for the glamorous introduction. Pleased to be here.
So, it's not really glamorous, at least in my mind. You know, your reputation precedes yourself, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us. I mean, this is the third time that you've been on the Franchise Today legal series, and we really do appreciate it. The first two times had to do with financial performance representations, and today, of course, we have a very big topic for you, Lane, private equity and franchising, due diligence and deal making. But, you know, before we jump into the meat of today's show, I know there was a couple of announcements over the last couple of days that I want to talk about. In the Philadelphia Business Journal, results were published in February 24th issue of the journal that Fisher Zucker has been ranked by basically your peers as one of the region's top 75 law firms in the Philadelphia business list. Certainly, that's a very high honor. And then also, you and your partner Jeffrey Zucker are honored as Legal Eagles in the April 2012 issue of Franchise Times in recognition of your professional achievement and reputation, again, amongst your peers. I mean, that just speaks volumes, and congratulations to you, Jeffrey, and the entire team at Fisher Zucker.
Well, I appreciate that, Paul. Thanks so much. That we just went public with that announcement yesterday. We were elated to have been identified as one of the top 75 firms, and it's always good when your accomplishments are recognized by others, so I appreciate the recognition by the Business Journal.
Absolutely, and I'm proud to announce it here to our listening audience as well. And as I said, almost as everyone in franchising knows, you're extremely involved with the IFA. You're on its board of directors, and among other things, you spearhead the membership committee. Please tell us, our audience, about the current membership recruitment efforts going on with the IFA Membership Committee.
Well, I appreciate that opportunity, Paul. I mean, despite all that IFA has to offer and all that it, all the initiatives that it's moved forward on Capitol Hill and its special programming like the Small Business Lending Summit on the 16th of this month, there are frankly still some franchisor companies that are not members. Over time, I became membership chair in 2006. In 2006, we had our most franchisor members at 1,260. We're currently at 1,125, and we're trying as hard as we can to try to finish this year out with as many new members as we had in 2000, as many franchisor members as we had in 2006. So I sort of want to, in the event that I actually will leave this post at some point, I always like to leave it better or as well as I found it. So we are rapidly moving to try to bring new folks in. IFA has an introductory membership program, which makes it, frankly, inexpensive and advantageous for any new franchisor to join under that program. It comes with a free pass to the IFA, the renowned IFA convention, which is in Las Vegas this year, and which probably costs, you know, half the cost, or at least a third of the cost of a two-year membership. Folks should be taking advantage of that. They should be coming and, frankly, bringing more of their organization or as much of their organization as they can afford to that event so that those folks can be brought along in their educational and, you know, other activities at the convention. But, yeah, there are folks that are still not members, Paul. I know that will come to a great shock to you and Joe because, of, you know, of how involved you are and how much you know is going on. But I think that folks are still uninformed in terms of the benefits of IFA membership and how much IFA accomplishes and has accomplished even since Steve Caldera has been here over the last 2 years in terms of, you know, knowing where things are at.
Well, certainly with your leadership of the membership committee, I know we'll definitely make progress towards the goals and objectives increasing the membership. And one other thing I'd like to talk about before we get into private equity and franchising is the recently completed UnConference that is part of your giving back to the franchise community. I know you and Don and Brad Fishman put this together some years ago, and it really has evolved into really something great and very well talked about throughout the community. If you would, just give us a quick overview of, you know, why, how, and what to expect in the future from the UnConference.
Well, again, I appreciate that opportunity. Well, a couple years ago, Brad Fishman from Fishman Public Relations and Don Lewin from Hot Dish Advertising, Don Kane, and I came up with the idea of inviting folks to a ski trip that we actually had already been in progress in terms of having gone in prior years with some IFA folks, Scott Lehrer and Paul Rocchio. And we wondered if folks would actually join us if invited, and it sort of took off from there. This year we had almost 180 people. We had more than nearly 100 franchisors, 70 some of whom were represented by their CEO or president or other high-ranking officer. It created folks, frankly, who hadn't turned out at other events or we hadn't met or seen at other events, came out. The programming is limited. It's undertaken in the morning on each of 2 days. After the programming is done, folks retreat to either the ski lodge or the mountain or snowmobiling or the town. We had the amazing good fortune this year of having like nearly 60-degree weather for the whole time we were out there and still having snow. So it created an opportunity for folks who were novice skiers to get better under ideal conditions. In terms of the caliber of programming and networking, we had an amazing opportunity in that CBS, the broadcast network for Undercover Boss, announced just days before that three of our clients were going to be on it, and that's sort of the point at which the people are go public, if you will. So we found ourselves at that moment with five Undercover Bosses in attendance, and then immediately invited a producer from Studio Lambert, who produces, which is the studio that produces the Undercover Boss show and another show called Be the Boss. And so in short order, we had an amazing sort of kickoff to a panel discussion where folks talked about, you know, the risks and rewards associated with putting yourself out there, which I think is what folks do when they join a reality show. The conversation became much less specifically related to Undercover Boss and more about the risks of companies when they are asked to put themselves out there, and it made for an amazing discussion that folks talked about the rest of the day, frankly. And then the next day we talked extensively about matters. We created what we called an Unpanel of the Pros, and we asked all of our attendees, since they were so high caliber, to imagine themselves facilitating a panel among all of your guests, including anybody else who was attending the conference, and develop questions that you'd ask of them. And you wouldn't believe the time spent by folks and the caliber and quality of the questions that came in for people. And so we, Jeff Hill from Work, did an amazing job facilitating a discussion. We heard from, you know, it's a circumstance where you have some gigantic franchisors in the room, like Steve Joyce from Choice Hotels, who was more than generous with sharing his intelligence, if you will, about the economy, about healthcare. David Barr gave his perspective on healthcare. So it was some extraordinarily high-level discussion undertaken in a relatively short time period, and then a completely unusual forum to continue those discussions or have more group discussions on that or other topics with our folks in this ski setting where nobody's dressed up. You can't tell. There's no ties, barely a button-down shirt to be seen, and folks really being themselves and really getting a chance to know people on that level. So I don't know if you wanted me to go into that detail, but thank you for that opportunity, and I'm grateful for all the folks that came and supported our event with wine and our pack auction. We raised a bunch of money for Franpack. Our folks are extraordinarily generous. I think we had more than almost 20 max donors present that were $5,000 donors. We had, you know, maybe half a dozen past chairs of IFA, just an incredibly talented and seasoned group of veterans to lead discussions and help give back, as you pointed out earlier, to the folks that don't know as much.
What a wealth of information and knowledge and expertise under one roof. Certainly a great event. I know, Brad, we did a show a couple of weeks ago, and Brad gave us a rundown and talked about even some of the fun things at the Olympic Center, all the different wine, and of course, knowing Ron Feldman was part of the group, I know that was probably some of the best wine. And of course, Brad also alluded to the midnight McDonald's run. So, you know, great time, and appreciate all you've been doing for and continue to do for franchising. But as we talk about today's topic, private equity, certainly it can be considered a very complex topic. And as we only have the next 45 minutes or so, we'll probably need to be more generalized. But probably in tune with the majority of our listening audience is interested in. So maybe we can start with the broader aspects, Lane, and then move on to some of the practical examples of things you look for in the due diligence process. And I'll start off with, at what point of the transaction does the due diligence work typically begin?
All right, so let me back up for 1 second and try to zoom out. So what we've seen in our practice representing 75 different franchise systems, in addition obviously being involved in the activities you identify, is that private equity has taken a premier role in terms of franchisors' capital structure. And while every company is not a candidate for it and every company is not of a size and shape that would lend itself today to a private equity investment, it's pretty clear if you look through a telescope down to folks that are in it longer than you that private equity has played a dramatic role in capitalizing either the next stage or the final stage or every stage of a franchisor's growth. So that's why I proposed to you that this topic might be of some interest. I would say to you that transactions usually percolate or arise in two distinct scenarios. One is in a private transaction where buyers and sellers find one another, and in that case, buyers are typically unwilling to invest the time and resources necessary to do a comprehensive due diligence without some sort of either exclusive dealing period or some period of time to protect their work product, because they don't want the seller just taking their information and then shopping for higher bidders. In many cases, however, especially for larger companies, the transactions are initiated or introduced through investment bankers who are trying to make a market for the transaction. And in those cases, it very may well be that a book, if you will, goes out to a lot of potential bidders that have the wherewithal to close and perhaps they think an inclination to move forward. And then due diligence materials are often assembled in a data room, which we can talk about more later, but in electronic format. And they're offered up to folks who are in the bidding process, and sometimes they're divided into more general stuff first, and it gets more specific as you advance to further stages in the negotiations. But in those cases, a lot of times the core due diligence information or the contracts and those things are assembled based on what they think folks will want, and they're offered up to folks usually on a very much shorter time period than you can humanly take to review them, and you know, offered up for inspection and hopefully reaction and analysis prior to obviously when the next timing milestone goes by under the whatever the document is. It sometimes arises in a private transaction under a letter of intent or an agreement of sale, and those documents are usually very specific about what you'll see, when you'll see it, and how long you have to react to it.
You know, certainly in today's day and age of instant gratification and often ready, fire, aim type of philosophy, certainly the a private equity transaction has a process that, you know, obviously doesn't lend towards instant gratification and certainly could potentially be catastrophic in a ready, fire, aim type of philosophy. So along the lines of that process, how do you like to start the process and what guides it along?
Well, I like to start the process. I mean, folks often say, what do you want? So let's assume talk first about private transactions. It would start with us asking for, we have a comprehensive due diligence list of materials that we ask for in typical franchise transactions, where we try to ask for everything under the sun with the expectation that much of it will not exist, and they may exist, you know, ESOPs and weird, you know, types of you know, former ways of doing business, you wouldn't expect necessarily to find things, but you want to make sure that you ask the question and you ask for documents which are responsive to that to those issues. So we start with a very comprehensive list. We then talk through what can be assembled most immediately, what's already been assembled, what would take time to assemble, what might be produced later in time rather than earlier in time. But I generally like to control that process and determine, you know, when the information will be there and that it will be delivered in a complete format and not piecemeal or in, you know, parts that make us have to go back and forth. The benefit or detriment, I mean, all the information today is produced through a data room. A data room is, I think, less costly than having to send a team out to go through hard copies of records. But they also create an electronic footprint for the information that was produced and an electronic footprint for what you chose to review or not review. So it becomes very clear what you what was provided in response to this request and then whether you looked at it or not.
You know, even though franchise organizations, large and small, have varying unique characteristics, you know, the uniqueness in the concept, run different ways. I think a common denominator, though, that brings it back to the similarities involved between the organizations comes down to, you know, franchise agreements, franchise leases, and a lot of, obviously, the legal documents. What particular attributes or even deficiencies are you evaluating when you're reviewing those franchise agreements and franchisee leases?
Well, first let's talk about sort of the universe of information we try to assemble. So what we're trying to find are all forms of franchise agreement that are currently in use in a system. Because you want to see there's probably the one that they wrote most recently, which is indicative of their willingness or intention to sell the company, and then there may be older forms of agreement going back that may or may not be you know, consistent with today's best practices. So we first try to identify all the different forms of agreement, and then we look to see whether they have what we view as, for simplicity purposes, the critical contract terms, like whether there are degrees of security, whether there are collateral assignments of leases or telephone numbers which secure the franchisee's performance, whether there's a contractual right in the lease, as you point out, for a franchisor to assume, whether there's personal guarantees on the part of the principals, or whether there are restrictive covenants that are enforceable as against individuals and entities, whether there are any security interests in the assets reserved by the franchisor, you know, what provisions are made for alternative channels of distribution other than the one that the franchisee is specifically granted, any advertising type issues, any upgrade or remodeling provisions, and how they might, what the timing of those are, and whether folks have historically brought their units into compliance with current remodeling specs, the ability to change the system through either changes in the ops manual or changes in the contract that are contemplated in the contract itself. We also look for that there's unrestricted transferability provisions and that the agreements themselves can be transferred. So we're looking for stuff that we see in most every current form of agreement, or at least what we see being engaged as an industry best practice, and only trying to identify what where the current documents stack up. We also look, just to round that out, as to what the company's renewal and update practices have been. In other words, have they, on renewal, have they updated the system, and have they, you know, potentially obtained releases or whatever their practice is. Not necessarily saying that anyone is ideal, good, or bad, but just to the extent it's consistent with what we've otherwise seen, because I think each of these are fact-specific and really depends on the underlying system much more than it is some contractual conclusion that you reach.
You know, you referred to a checklist, and I'm sure listening to you go through all this, that even the development of the checklist in general was quite a process in itself. But it seems like when you would get involved with a franchise company, at least from my perspective and my experience within franchising, and I know Joe has experienced quite a bit of that himself, relates to, you know, area developers and these existing development agreements that, you know, we read about all the time where somebody is, you know, committed to opening, you know, 50 units and a lot of times barely gets one or two off the ground. So how do you assess the quality of existing development agreements and specifically with regard to, you know, territory and compliance according to those agreements?
Well, okay, that's a good question. So first, I think that it's important to distinguish between the type of development agreement, because I think there are multi-unit agreements that have exclusive or non-exclusive territory and that have a development schedule. There's area rep type arrangements where you're sort of a hybrid and you have a duty to find franchisees to help open. And I think it's important to understand what type of agreement you have and how you've gone about it, particularly in the area world. Allocating responsibility and obligations, because I think you need to understand that to understand what how high a quality, you know, the person needs to be in terms of what the if there's any fee splits or those other kind of a deal. So they're obviously very different. And multi-unit agreements, which I think your question pertained to, the open units themselves over a predefined time period, we look for a couple things. We look for the level to which the operator is in compliance with the development agreement, if they're out of compliance, how far out of compliance, and if they're out of compliance, what are the causes of being out of compliance. And then we would look to try to see what this, you know, compare the size of the territory to the current individual franchise areas that are being given and try to determine the level and extent to which the development obligation of the operator matches the growth expectations for the territory. Again, not that it's bad or good, but just to identify where the franchisor has obligations to third parties that obviously a buyer or someone looking to step into the franchisor's shoes should be aware of. So, I mean, that's what we look to. It's mostly, we mostly look to see where they are in terms of compliance.
Sure, sure. What do you look at in terms of franchise system, rate of growth, turnover, or even churn of units? And of course, franchisee separation issues.
Ooh, that was a mouthful. Well, in terms of growth, I mean, we look at the item 20 charts, and we look at them year over year, obviously, to make sure they're consistent because we're looking at multiple ones. We try to identify sort of what the year-over-year rate of growth is, whether it's you know, new growth or whether it's a turnover of the same existing units. The more turnover there is, the more the next inquiry would focus on how they – the system exits with its franchisees when they exit, because that will put more people into potentially a statute of limitations issue with respect to ones that left within the statute of limitations window. So but we try to identify sort of what the year-over-year growth has been like, that it's been consistent, and that it analyze what to what extent it's attributed to a turnover of existing units. Also, in terms of separation, it would be, you know, what franchisor's practices are. Obviously, the best practice is to get a release on the end of any relationship that involves franchising. And some folks have a, you know, a practice of getting releases, and that's a better practice, I think, than just leaving them, you know, open. But we're trying to identify what that documentation looks like in this process.
We're broadcasting live today on Franchise Today in the first of seven segments in the third annual Franchise Legal Series, which will run through May 24th. And my guest today is Lane Fisher, preeminent of the preeminent law firm Fisher Zucker and recent recipient of a Franchise Legal Eagle Award of Franchise Times. And Lane, how far back do you go on historical documents such as FDDs or even back to UFOCs? How far back do you go, and what specifically are you looking for?
Well, okay, so I think that the answer is it depends. Or had franchises, so because some of those states have particular statutes that have statutes of limitations. So I would say on average they're 3 or 4 years. If it was somebody who was transacting business everywhere, there might be claims that could arise if there were misrepresentations made in the FDD that might meet a state's definition of fraud, that might be 2 or 4 years, depending on the state. So that gives you some guidance, but not a ton. I would say that our advice is always to keep FDDs associated with agreements that have are currently in effect or for franchisees that have in effect. We like to have a practice of maintaining the whole file in the event something happens with a subsequent agreement. The question arises as to the disclosure with respect to the prior agreement. But as a practical matter, that there are certain claims that will be, depending on where the franchisor transacts business, outside of the applicable statute of limitations, and the need for those FDDs may be lower than the other ones I've described.
Let's say.
Hey, Lane, this is Joe. You know, you're working a transaction, you're doing the due diligence. I'm curious about what happens or what do you tell franchisors about the selling of franchises? Can a potential transaction impact the franchisor's ability to sell franchises to new candidates or execute franchise agreements that might be under a development agreement? What happens in that if you're in the middle of a deal and you've got your franchising activities, you've got your franchise pipeline?
Well, I mean, I would say this, that the answer is it very well may impact it, and the timing and the when, where, and how are often and frankly, I think exclusively fact-specific. So there's no one-size-fits-all answer. There obviously is a point at which you need to update your document and register your document with a material change in it, and there is certainly some point at which a particular kind of transaction structured in that in a particular kind of way would trigger that disclosure obligation. But I can also think about transactions there is probably a conceivable way to structure them where they wouldn't necessarily require broad-sweeping amendments. But I think you need to make sure that you have competent counsel look at the impact, because when companies in any transaction, you're buying based on cash flow, usually in a franchise context, you're counting on uninterrupted cash flow. And so any point at which you get frozen or suspended or just have a waiting period in a registration state is something that people should be eyes wide open. And any structure, any decisions made in terms of structure or timing should be made in a way to try to minimize that any downtime in the state. There's certain circumstances where you can try to even perpetuate an existing franchisor's renewal as opposed to come in as a new franchisor. If you filed it in the next, on let's say the 29th of April, you'll probably have a lot longer delay because most everybody's due at around April 30, rather than if you did it in January or you did it in November. So there's a lot of things that go into the analysis, but something that somebody needs to have their eye on the ball as they attempt to move a transaction like this forward.
You know, Lane, all kinds of things can come up in due diligence. I know from personal experience in various companies I've been with. What do you do when a franchisor tells you that, hey, you know what, by the way, we goofed and we sold 3 franchises in a registration state where we weren't registered, or our registration had lapsed and we didn't notice it?
Well, I mean, at first, the first question is, okay, so registration lapsed. That is a bad thing in that you were not regulatorily compliant. But the second question, a more important question, is were there any franchises sold during that time period? Were people disclosed during that time period? Did anybody who bought, they disclosed prior to that time period? And is that potential disclosure still good? I don't know if I'm answering your question, Joe.
It's just, you know, you've got the franchisee may be operating, and you know, I think it probably makes a difference on the length of time that they've been operating, but the fact that you may have sold an unregistered franchise in a registration state, you know, what do you do to remediate that or ameliorate that issue?
Got it. So most disclosure violations are potentially curable, and in fact, if you either disclose it or an examiner finds it in reviewing your document that there are franchises that appeared during a time period they know you weren't registered, they may make you correct it or fix it as a condition of getting registered. It depends. Sometimes it starts with whether the franchise agreements in question are actually in compliance. Sometimes they're, you know, units that haven't been open in 10 years but have never been terminated. So, I mean, you have to first figure out whether they involve units which are agreements which are attached to open and operating units. Many times the buyer, it'll be just a matter of a business decision or negotiation whether the seller will try to resolve it in many cases we're involved in, the buyers want the sellers to resolve those claims because they want to figure out whether it's going to be the agreement's going to not be in a unit or whether it's going to be associated with an exit and potentially a disclosure issue. So a lot of times you'd want to make sure that you'd want that undertaken in the hands of the seller. But I've also seen transactions where the buyer takes it with knowledge. There's some either indemnification promise to make the buyer whole if in the event that regulatory infraction turns into either a fine or a penalty or a monetary claim by a franchisee. And so there's ways to protect the buyer on either side. If it's a big system and a big transaction, one or two, wouldn't, I don't think, stop the presses, but there are certain kinds. We're always leery of taking essentially, it's sometimes referred to as junk in the trunk, but, you know, there's agreements that are not, that are otherwise terminable but just haven't been, and you don't want to, there's no benefit to you taking, if you're assuming the transaction structure is an asset deal, to buying agreements you know to be in a default or know to be, you know, ready to litigate, because that only creates additional disclosure obligations for you going forward for stuff you really had very little control over. But to answer your question, Joe, there's a way to fix it.
It was a complicated question. You gave a complicated answer. I think you did great.
Yeah, I love the junk in the trunk analogy there. Lane, a lot of conversations, of course, in franchising are about, you know, franchise sales, franchise development. If somebody's looking this type of transaction, of course, they're looking at growth. They're looking at, you know, forecasting, look at projections, where can we go, what states can we go, are we going to go international, et cetera. But let's pull back a moment and look at the foundation of the franchise organization, which, of course, I'm referring to, you know, operations and training. And is it important for you to see operations manuals and to get a full understanding how training is delivered to the franchisees?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably better folks on the due diligence team to assess the quality of the manuals themselves. I mean, I would be looking at them to see that they're substantive, that they're related to the brand in question, that they're not, you know, completely boilerplate, that they seem to detail the specific operations of that business. With respect to training, I would look to see that the training program matches the one that's described in the franchise agreement and that they actually deliver the substance that's identified in their various FDDs. In that program itself, and that it's a real deal, and that, you know, and I would look to see what level and extent to which they graduate people or keep records of folks' successful completion, award certificates, you know, bring people along in the process, and obviously have a successful track record of training people in the skill sets necessary to be successful in business, which I guess is the proof's in the pudding, depending on how many units they have of folks who have been through the training program and are operating successful units.
Yeah, it's interesting. You gave a good perspective there that it really is a cross-platform type of approach, making sure that, you know, one thing coincides with the other. The, you know, what's in the operations manual coincides with the table contents of the operations manual and the FDD. See what's being mentioned in marketing documents, and I think a lot of people, especially the non-legal people that listen to the show, you know, kind of lose sight of that at times. And, you know, so there's a lot of important components within a franchise organization that have to be considered beyond the standard legal aspects that many people assume are the case. And another one that we talk about a lot is franchise advisory councils. Now, whether they're official or unofficial independent franchisee associations or even influential franchisees, you know, how does all of that, you know, and specifically, let me rephrase it to a question, how do franchise advisory councils, official or unofficial independent franchisee associations, and influential franchisees relate to due diligence? And I guess the second part is, do their perceptions matter?
Well, okay, so that's a mouthful as well. I think the first thing we try to do is identify the various constituencies of which advisory council members, prominent franchisees, or any franchisee leader would, you know, fit into that category. I think sure it matters. I mean, I think it's a good thing to have franchisees generally own multiple units of what they started out. I think it legitimizes the multi-unit profitability, and I think is a good, probably the principal means to attract other multi-unit franchisees. I would say that you always want to try to measure the degree of franchisee satisfaction, and sometimes, you know, and you, so the presence of these kinds of organizations, what their current role, if any, or the role of any franchisees in any decision making, whether they're happy and satisfied, whether there's any contractual commitments to, or obligations to get their approval on any particular items, is all very important. I would say that you know, it's always a buy in a buyer's interest to get to know and to understand the motivations and the what motivates folks to open more units, how they would see their system evolving or developing, and trying to figure out whether people are on the same page with respect to how they're going to achieve their respective goals. Usually it's to grow the company, and certainly the folks that have, some franchisors, as you know, have no operating units, and so that the only place you'll get a perspective of what the competitive landscape looks like, or what the customer looks like, or how the customer experience is exchanged, is through feedback from those folks, and folks that have multiple units of what you have obviously have a broader experience base to share. Now, and so it's always important to, I think, get their feedback, determine the level and, you know, how you, they see them, their investments growing, how they view their exit strategies, and try to determine that it's, you know, to what level and extent it's consistent with the ones you have or the ones the franchisor has had.
Sure. What are some of the supply chain considerations to take into account in this process?
Well, you know what I just would say is an observation that, that many systems that have a lot of throughput of either branded product or materials or supplies that are bought through or through approved or designated suppliers often have more value because they're selling these products and there's a separate profit center in distribution. Obviously, systems that aren't large enough can't economize or efficiently attack distribution, but as they grow and as they grow more geographically, big opportunities come into play. And so first, so looking at the supply chain, it's who are the suppliers? Are they approved or designated? So are they under contract? Are there private label or branded goods? Are the branded goods available elsewhere? Are people historically buying from the approved supplier? To what level are folks voluntarily complying? And then I think you want to look to the contracts again, Paul, to the level and extent to which you people can require or pool purchases, or designate suppliers that haven't been previously designated. It's fairly well recognized that the benefit associated with pool purchasing is something that folks routinely look for a franchise system to deliver. And, you know, a buyer will always want to determine the level and extent to which the distribution network, if it had one, could it, you know, can folks, you know, what does the contract say about folks dealing with that if the franchisor is a supplier, if there are multiple suppliers, and to try to get your arms around that.
You know, really opens up my mind a lot, you know, thinking through this process. And you spoke earlier about providing the franchise organization and the executives with a checklist, which, of course, identifies the various things that you need to see, contracts, files, leases, agreements, et cetera. Is there an example of something you don't want or really don't need to see?
I mean, I think that the challenge in doing due diligence is that, I mean, you could say I want to see every single piece of paper and undertake to read it. That's not a very efficient way to approach it, and it often won't, because you'll need to be giving reports and timing milestones that are not consistent with looking at every sheet of paper. So, I mean, I just think it's an organized methodology that stuff's produced that's responsive to various questions that are asked. I don't know that there's anything I don't want to see, like, you know, I don't know if that's the hear no evil, you're doing the shirt thing, but, I mean, I want to see everything that's relevant. I want to see anything that's going to have an impact on the buyer. I want to see anything that's going to potentially be unusual or create obligations to third parties on behalf of either the present buyer or the purchaser, or create causes of action or claims. So there's nothing I don't want to see, but there's probably documents which would be beyond the scope of what I would need to see to try to make an intelligent report identifying, you know, the current risk with the system, or at least the, you know, the due diligence report in terms of what we found.
And as you're moving along and looking through these files, you know, obviously the question with respect to terminated franchisees, litigation, and dispute arise, what do you look for in those type of files and in looking back at litigation and disputes?
Well, you look at, like, the number of claims, the commonality of the causes of action that are raised by people. You're looking for if everybody's kind of saying the same thing. As to concluded litigation, or concluded terminations, you'd like to have a document which ties it all out. Certainly if there's a release, that makes it easier. If not, you know, is the litigation properly disclosed, and has it been properly and historically disclosed at the time it arose or when the obligation to disclose it arose? So it has a variety of different uses, but, you know, you're trying to assess what the state of the union is, with, and in terms of the number of such terminated franchisees and to what level and extent they've been, the relationship has been concluded on a, you know, by contract as opposed to just leaving it out there.
You know, understanding the sensitivity of the information and confidentiality that you go through with your clients, and I totally understand that, and I think our listening audience understands that as well. So in general terms, as you can, what are some of the more common issues or baggage that gets turned up in this process?
Okay, I would say, like, many companies have either poor documentation or documentation which isn't assembled in one convenient place related to materials that reside on mail only, and they're not ever ultimately routed to the file where they would be maintained for either litigation or for just file maintenance purposes. Sometimes we come across with respect to certain agreements, you know, no signed receipts or acknowledgments. Sometimes we find lapses in registration, and sometimes it matters or is more significant depending on whether sales are made. Sometimes you find contingent liabilities, you know, like a franchisor is on every lease as a guarantor or something, which come up to be, you know, those kind of obligations. Sometimes you find, you know, no, you know, executed contracts we've come across, and you hope to find less of those, and folks getting ready for the process sometimes identify those deficiencies and try to fill the holes in before turn the docs over. But that, you know, those kind of things you might find in development agreements, you know, bigger territories than you'd expect, or older territories that have a smaller development obligation. You might find heavily negotiated amendments, depending, and that reflect negotiated changes off the regular form of agreement, and that's always something that we're trying to not identify necessarily as good or bad, but as deviations from the standard form. So that's the kind of stuff we've come across.
Hey, Lance, Joe, got an email from a listener asking a question, congratulating you on being a great guest, but he's curious about the role of an attorney or an investment banker. How do they look at the company's out-year projections in terms of adequacy during the due diligence process?
Repeat the question? I'm sorry.
They're curious about what role the attorney or investment banker takes in looking at the company's out-year projections in terms of adequacy during the due diligence process. I'm reading it to you the way they wrote it, so I don't have the benefit of asking them to clarify.
I mean, here's where it would be in terms of, I think where we would look at it anyway, in terms of there's often projections that have been tendered to the buyer, but the fact is those projections have to be consistent with whatever the traditional historical growth rate has been. Certainly somebody looking to raise money that has the goal of increasing the number of units they intend to open would want to be able to demonstrate that they would use the funds raised for that purpose. So in terms of, just so I understand the question, I mean, I think we're talking about projections that are shared with the buyer, not projections that we come across in due diligence that are shared with prospects. because that would be obviously that's the subject of our last two interviews on earnings claims and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I think this question relates to projections because it involves an investment banker that would be shared with a buyer and how somebody might look at whether they're realistic. And I think that that's exactly what folks would do. They look at prior budgets, attaining prior budgets, and the budget goals being consistent with what someone in the world has actually achieved as opposed to one that is not grounded in fact or reality.
Yeah.
Elaine, we talked about, you know, systems, we talked about operations manuals, we talked about the documents. Let's look at the people side of this. You know, how do you measure the strength of franchisor management and infrastructure, and why is it important to identify post-transaction change agents within the franchisor leadership team?
Well, I think, you know, you want to evaluate the strength of franchisor management and infrastructure, and I think the way you do that is you determine that the folks running the company or that have a lot of underlying experience, and not only there's experience obviously in franchising and then experience in the underlying business. We always look to see the level and extent to which these leaders have accomplished their benefit and value they brought to other systems. But there is a subjective element to it, but the folks that the leaders have generally accomplishments that are that pepper their wake and then identify them as folks that have gotten stuff done in terms of how they, you know, grow companies. And I think that it's important to make sure that to the extent possible that franchisors and franchisees can develop a win-win strategy in terms of trying to effectuate change, because even change is not bad. Change sometimes is necessitated by competition and trying to keep up with what your competitors are doing. So, I mean, what we've seen is the most effective companies have folks in the position of trying to garner consensus and trying to approach and develop approaches to these items that try to diffuse to them versus you and try to identify how together we're going to mutually achieve our goals. And I think those goals are easier to get folks to support.
Well, looking at the legalese now real quick, and a question that often comes up is, you know, what are representations and warranties and how do they work, maybe in a simple 101 answer?
Reps and warranties exist in almost every form of agreement of sale, and they're where folks are saying stuff like that they've complied with all laws. Sometimes the reps and warranties say we've complied with all laws except, or that we are not aware of any pending or threatened litigation except, and there creates a band of exhibits that try to talk about things that make that are not inconsistent with that absolute representation. There are points where the buyer is entitled to rely on these statements by the seller in the course of making the transaction. Now, when you have these exceptions that are dealt with on these schedules, they're often dealt with again so it's essentially stuff that you're agreeing typically that the buyer may agree or be responsible for. So there's no litigation, but there's this pending franchisee case, and sometimes the seller is going to remain responsible for it, either for the defense of it or for the ultimate cash liability of it. And so reps and warranties are often related to an indemnification type provision where the seller agrees to protect the buyer from that claim and essentially be responsible for it. Depending on how many indemnified claims there are, sometimes you see the deal terms changing or transaction price coming down or amounts being held in escrow until either those claims are asserted and resolved or until unexpired statutes of limitation elapse, and for time periods that are really very deal specific.
Well, as we're getting into the final stretch, and it's amazing how quick an hour goes by, I wanted to just touch on a couple of things you mentioned earlier. You mentioned a data room. You know, what's a virtual data room, and why would it be essential to this type of transaction?
Well, I mean, a data room is sort of the common embodiment of how folks share their due diligence information, their contracts, and their written documentation to potential buyers. Unlike the old days where boxes were requested from storage and stuff was moved into some centralized conference room facility and then folks came locally to look at it, documents today are scanned up in electronic format, and you are invited to view them in a very controlled and limited environment which is very restrictive as to who. You need to make sure that folks in your organization that need to get in are granted permission on the front end, because access is not nearly fully granted, and it's only granted after multiple forms of confidentiality are signed. But it allows folks to look at documentation at no transportation or lodging costs, so that you can essentially from your desk dial in and look at things. It has made competitive bidding environments interesting because, you know, information is shared, folks have probably not nearly enough time to review or digest it, and then they need to decide what they'll do, whether they're going to proceed to the next level of bidding. And data rooms make the provision of stages of information very easy to sort of upload and give folks universal access to and cut off access to at a particular time. So it's the modern view. It's not inexpensive to set up. I haven't seen any done, you know, another way, looking at the old-fashioned way of looking at the documents. nobody invites us to do that anymore. They send us an electronic invitation to the data room, and we look at stuff. So what that means, frankly, is that your documents might get looked at sooner than they might have otherwise gotten looked at.
Sure.
To move a whole due diligence team is something that would occur at a later stage of the transaction, but be able to look at your forms of franchise agreement, your registration files, and those kind of things, they could be scanned up and looked at. So I think the learning point here is that folks, you know, need to maintain their files in a way that they, frankly, have everything centralized, in a way that they could be easily produced, with the expectation that if you want to grow, if you want to grow like the gross majority of other franchisors do, you may be in this pool or environment sooner rather than later, and that you should maintain your documents accordingly.
You know, and we touched on a lot of information today, and I really appreciate you giving this information and providing this information. Are your clients surprised at the depth and detail involved in this due diligence process?
I don't. You know, the fact is that we create summary reports. The answer is yes. They're always surprised that we go that frankly, on either side, we go into great detail. Obviously, I think buyers are always surprised at what sellers ask for. Our clients are never surprised when they're buying the level and quantity of information that we'll ultimately request. But yeah, I think that they're surprised at the depth. They're surprised at why these things are relevant to value or price, or certain rights may put revenues at risk. Why, you know, generous you know, amendments to franchise agreements, which seem harmless and frankly appropriate at the time that they're entered into, might have, you know, longer term ramifications. So I think the answer to that is all yes.
As we close in, we got a couple of minutes left, and this is probably what everybody's been waiting for. What can a franchisor do to get their house in order in advance of a deal? Maybe share some tips on contract administration, records retention, what have you.
Well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of checklists out there. We certainly have them available to anybody who wants them, that would tell folks sort of what their, you know, what information should end up in their franchise closing file when they sell, or when they, you know, close on the sale of a franchise, and then what kind of documents should be routinely collected, and what policy should be adopted by a franchisor in terms of document, not transmission, but consolidation and retention, because we see lots of folks don't do any of that. We think things like getting releases when you end relationships, things like getting compliance certifications, which are those statements that franchisees sometimes sign or say that they weren't promised anything other than what was in the FDD, are great housekeeping things to have. Routinely and cataloged and put in a safe place with the rest of this stuff. I think that folks, as they work through their item 19s, not to go back to that tired topic, but as they work through their item 19s to make sure that they maintain the kind of substantiating documentation that's required under the rules, so they can demonstrate, even in the absence of the preparer for that year, that they can. And you know, that's something that, you know, some people have to go reach out and find a former, you know, CFO or, you know, whoever was involved in it. But it's important to document all that stuff and to have it cataloged, so for easy future reference.
Well, great. Lane, we really do appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to be with us on the first segment in our third annual Franchise Legal Series. We really do appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Paul, and I appreciate all the kind words about my firm and IFA, and I look forward to seeing you and others at the Multi-Unit Conference. And remember, there's the Small Business Lending Summit, which IFA created to match lenders with folks in need of such things. And so,
yeah,
that's
absolutely. I appreciate you mentioning that. Next week is our second segment in the series with Lee Plave, and we'll be talking about social media and some of the legal aspects. Until then, my name is Paul Segreto, wishing you the best, the very best, in this great thing we call franchising. Franchise Today is out.